Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah. All right, it's time for another toy department, and I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. This is exciting for me because we're opening the podcast with breaking Matt Kolsky news. And I want to point out before we get to your news, I'm not trying to step on this announcement, but I have no idea what it is you're about to say. So I could very well be overhyping whatever this is because I honestly don't know. But we were, you know, talking before the pod. You said you got some big changes coming up. So, well, let's hear about them.
Yeah. Well, what I said was my life's about to change. And I meant that most directly in the realm of my sleeping schedule.
Okay.
Because the announcement, for lack of a better term, and this is not the announcement, it's been officially announced, but for those of you who somehow found this podcast without being hounds on my Twitter, I'm going to be hosting a daily sports talk show on 95.7 The Game in San Francisco from 5 to 6 a.m. Weekday morning.
Congratulations, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
Does the show have a name?
It is the pregame, you know, because we've got the game. And this is the first hour of the day, getting you ready for the local morning show. An extra hour of live local programming, as they say in the biz.
All right. So you're going an extra hour live and local with the pregame daily.
Daily, Monday through Friday, 5 a.m., 95.7 The Game in San Francisco, 95.7 FM, or on the radio.com app. Thank you very much.
Are you going to take calls on this show?
Yep. Going to take calls, going to probably do the occasional guest, but what it really is just a chance to get a jump on the day in sports, in my mind. You know, this is going to be, like I said, the idea is get live and local earlier, and so this is, you know, today in Bay Area sports with me, and I'm very excited about it.
I'm very excited for you. Is this the first time that you've had a 5 days a week talk show?
It's the first time I've had a 5 days a week talk show with my name on it. Yes.
Yeah. That's kind of what I mean. Obviously I know you've been on shows that were 5 days a week.
Right. And a reasonably regular part of shows that are 5 days a week, but certainly this is the first time I'm going to have significant creative input into the style and framework of the show and all that sort of stuff. So it's a very exciting thing, and hopefully it'll go well.
All right. I have two questions.
Yes.
Neither of which are important, but the first relates to an old podcast topic of ours.
Uh-huh.
Does this mean I can now text you at 9 a.m.?
Yes. Yes, it does. Although now you can't text me after 9 a.m.
Okay. So I have to get him in early. All right.
Yeah, you got to get the text in early now because this is one of the things I have to figure out. Do I sleep from like 9 or 10 a.m. to 4 or 5 p.m. every day? Or do I, like, get a midday nap in and then another 3-4 hours from, say, 11 p.m. to 3? I'm going to have to be up at 3 a.m., and I've got to be awake from the hours of, like, 5:30 or 6 to probably 11 to actually watch the sports that I'm going to be talking about. So I have to figure out, do I sleep once or twice a day?
Yeah, you know, all the morning show people I know sort of negotiate this differently and find their own path. I've never done mornings. It's the one day part that I've never been in. But I've always envisioned that if I were to do it, I would want to try to make the morning show the end of my day, if that makes sense.
So. Yeah, see, that's kind of how I'm thinking. And, like, I'm going to have to sleep during the meat of the day to some degree. I just got to figure out, do I want to sneak a nap in between the sports and the show, or do I want to spend that few hours, you know, prepping and then watching a TV show or something like that. But yeah. We'll see.
I definitely invest in a some blackout curtains and like one of those.
My room is pretty well shaded, and I'm not bad at sleeping in some mild light. I'm a little worried about the September and October Bay Area heat wave during the days, but I'll survive.
All right, my second not important question is, have you guys ever thought about getting The Game as the voice guy?
Oh, man. Not until now. But,
how cool would that be?
Thanks for giving me an idea that I'm now desperately committed to and will never be able to make happen.
This is The Game, and you're listening to The Game. Be so great. I love it. All right. Well, congratulations, man. I'm excited for you. I'm curious to see how this will change the schedule of this podcast.
Yeah, it might. It might do.
But we'll figure all that out when we get to it. That is big news.
It is big news. It is big news. It's an exciting step for me. And again, I have high hopes and expectations as well.
All right. Well, I'm imagining that you're probably not going to be talking a lot of pop culture on that show, so we can still continue to be the forum where you get out your hot takes.
That's exactly the plan.
About the world of movies and television and music. And I say let us get to the hot takes this week. And maybe we should start with TV. I feel like, Sharp Objects – is the thing people are really talking about this week. It's definitely the only show people have texted me about and asked me if I watched. I don't know if that's true for you as well.
It definitely is, yes.
I feel like we definitely need to say now that it seems to me to be virtually impossible to talk about this season and really this series, because right, it's plan is for it not to go on without spoiling the ending in a major way. So if you have not seen Sharp Objects, just abandon and don't want to know how it ends, abandon it now, because
we
will talk about the ending in depth pretty much. Yeah,
absolutely. There's really not much else to talk about at this point.
Let's start there. Did you like the ending?
Loved. Okay. If I'm grading the series overall, I think I'm in the like B+ range, because I don't know that my love for the way it ended totally covers up all the warts. I do feel like it dragged at times, and it maybe was a little too convoluted at times. But, I mean, the acting top to bottom was, frankly, phenomenal. I don't know. There's not much else to say about it. I think everyone in that series was spectacular. And look, man, I mean, if you're going to have a twisty ending, the goal should be to just bamboozle the entire audience, right? And even though I think it's the best case of the end twist, in that I didn't see it coming really at all. And it tracked. You know, I both was surprised and also felt like it was earned.
Interesting. So I'm definitely with you on the first part of it. I mean, there are not a ton of moments in your TV year where you're like, whoa!
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that twist when it's, you know, when she finds the tooth in the dollhouse was definitely like a whoa for me. And then that was sort of like the little whoa. And then the scene in the credits when you you get the visual of I forget exactly how you say her name.
Emma.
In that kind of feral mode, like actually committing these crimes. That was like, whoa! I'm thankful to Alan Sepinwall, who warned me a couple days before to make sure to watch the credits. So I was at least
I have to thank my girlfriend for that.
I was at least attuned to hanging around. So yeah, so on a visceral level, I mean, that moment, obviously, it really, you know, packs a punch.
It was interesting. I don't know. Did you watch the sort of post-credit interviews with the director?
I did not. I did not do
so
that.
not to recap the whole thing, but one of the interesting things that Jean-Marc Vallée, the director, said was, I felt like the right way to pay this off was to have the shock twist moment, the don't tell mama, be the very last thing you see, and then boom, cut to black. But that he also wanted to pay off the, like, you know, what he said was, because Camille, Amy Adams' character, wasn't party to any of this and didn't witness it, it didn't make sense to, like, cut from her understanding into seeing the crimes. But he wanted to pay off the sort of faith and stick-to-itiveness of the audience by showing the crimes. So he gave it, like, just a little bit longer. You know, because it wasn't even, like, cut to credits and then 3 seconds later. It was, like, cut to credits and maybe, like, 10 seconds later.
Yeah.
Bring in the actual murders. And it was incredibly effective, I thought.
As I understand it, the book does contain, you know, like, there's a fair amount of pages that are after the discovery of who really committed the crime.
Right.
So that definitely was an interesting and different choice. I am a little less convinced than you are about how it tracked. To me, it does feel a little bit off key. Not off key is maybe the wrong word. Incongruous, maybe, for this show. My point is that here is a show that has been extremely languid. At times, a little bit dense. Certainly, a show that has not been very revealing at times, or, you know, sort of obscuring things at times, you know. And so, for me, the end, and maybe this is part of why it packed such a punch, was a little bit like, "Well, here it is," you know. And so, I'm not, you know, like it was sort of interesting. Now, I think the show maybe could have been less of those things. You know, so maybe it's a good thing that it sort of went that way. But to me, it did feel a little bit at odds with the 10 weeks of show that I had watched before, which at times was, I needed some help determining what was going on here.
But in a way, okay. I feel like I'm interpreting the same facts slightly differently, because, as you say, it was so convoluted, and that's why I say overall I'm still in maybe the B+ range. Is like, it, there were times where it could have been less of those things, and I'm not sure it paid to be as opaque as it was. But given the bizarre and sort of difficult nature of the whole season, the arrest and subsequent jailing of Adora seemed very easy, did it not?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
So like, in that way, I feel like the insane twist was befitting the style of the season. And also, I think if you go back, and this may be because I watched the sort of post game interviews, and they cut to some scenes earlier in the season, there were a lot of breadcrumbs here. There really were. From, you know, moments early in the season where Emma described her sort of relationship with the dead girls, all the way to her sort of the way she responded to her new friend in the final episode, where, like, you know, at the time we wrote them off as teenage silliness, probably, but upon examination, maybe we should have been paying closer attention. And to me, when I say it's earned, that's what I mean, is that the pieces were in place. There was just enough misdirection to totally bamboozle, I think, everybody.
Man, it seems like the friends of Amma are really getting off scot-free here, right? Since they were, in fact, active participants in multiple homicides.
It seems that way, yeah.
I probably shouldn't laugh about that, but
well, they are fake homicides.
Right, they are. They're not real homicides. I do have a couple more rabbit hole questions, but I'm going to try to hold those for a second. I just feel like, you know, if you look back at some of these great sort of twists, right? Like, you know, if I'm thinking about Fight Club or The Sixth Sense, you know, where like you had that reaction of like, oh my God, I want to go back and see if this tracks. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Usual Suspects, another great example. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I have no desire to do that with this show.
No, I think that's why I say it was helpful to watch that little, like, 3 minute after the episode thing, because it kind of did it for me. Because, no, and that's what I mean, again, about the convoluted nature of the... I'm not sure what I thought was a great ending. I'm not sure it totally paid off all of the mess we lived through. But as messes go, it was an enjoyable one, and it was one that, if nothing else, that mess served to set a really specific mood and bring us into this weird, dark, dank Missouri thing.
Yeah. All right, so here are my rabbit hole questions.
Okay.
The first is, how do you think the husband is feeling at the end of all of this? Because he's not really acknowledged. His wife is in prison. I'm not sure that's a good or a bad thing. His daughters are both out of the house. I'm also not sure that that's a good or a bad thing. Is he just psyched to sit around and listen to jazz records all day? Is he in tatters? Like, where do you think he's left at the end of all this?
That's a great question. I think it's one of those two, right? But one of the interesting things about this show is there was clearly a deliberate choice to not develop that character. And having not read the book, I don't know if that mimics the book, but the nature of that character was sort of, he's an undeveloped character.
Yeah.
To the point where I'm not even sure we actually got an official answer as to when he became a part of the family.
Yeah.
Right?
It seems like he's mostly an excuse to play jazz records on the show, isn't it? Like,
a little bit.
At the end of the day, like, I thought that some of the stuff with the police chief and him was going to kind of pay off somewhere, and never really did, right?
Only in that he, like, yelled at him in the barbershop.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's...
yeah, there was no... And it's not clear that the police chief did anything wrong other than enable this sort of disturbed woman.
Yeah.
So a lot of those questions are not answered.
Do you think he knows who really did it?
I think he does.
I kind of do too, but there's zero evidence of it, right? Is there?
Right. No. But I think that keeps with the undeveloped nature of the character, that like the one thing we know about him is like he has a deep bent towards acquiescence. He is not a flow disruptor. He is a flow goer with.
That indeed.
There's that moment in the final episode where Adora is mashing up God knows what drugs to poison her daughters, and he says, "Don't overdo it." And she says, she's kind of like, "Shut up." And he's like, "All right, well, it's your area."
Yeah.
And
that would suggest he doesn't know, right? Because I don't think he would be like, "Hey, don't overdo it on the poison."
Really? I think that's almost, I kind of thought that was exactly what he was saying.
I don't know. I feel like he's sort of like, don't overdo it on the medicine. I think he was thinking she was helping.
Maybe. But even if he doesn't explicitly know what Adora's doing, I think he has an idea, or he wouldn't have said that. Because you don't tell a normal mother not to overdo it with the cold medicine.
I guess. I don't know. I could maybe say you might tell that particular mother. You know, Munchausen by proxy seems to be fairly overrepresented in pop culture,
in media,
doesn't it?
That is so true. How is it that literally everyone knows what Munchausen by proxy is? Like, it's not a common enough thing for everyone in the world to know what it is.
I'm not even sure it's the most common form of Munchausen.
No, I don't think it is. I think Munchausen to yourself is much more common. But Munchausen by proxy is fun for TV.
It sure is. It sure is. All right. So here's my second rabbit hole question. How does Camille have scar writing on her back?
I asked the same question. I have no idea. Could not figure that out. Wonder deeply if that is somehow explained in the book.
Yeah. Although I kind of doubt it would be, because it would seem to be almost impossible to explain, right? Other than someone else did it, right? That would seem to be the only plausible explanation.
Yeah, or like an elaborate scheme involving multiple mirrors and like a back scratcher.
Yeah, like right, you'd have to be able to write backwards in the mirror, like on your. I don't know. That seems like a weird one.
Yes, it seems it's. There's really no accounting for it. The very first time we saw her back, I turned to my girlfriend and said, "How did she do that?"
Yeah, it's true.
And I have not yet come up with any satisfactory answer.
That is why initially I just sort of thought other people were writing on her, because it seemed like she, you know, right? That was
like it was a form of abuse of some kind?
Yeah, yeah. That it wasn't cutting, you know? I mean, it was cutting, obviously, but it wasn't, you know, the way we think of it.
Right. No, I mean, but obviously it was, you know, self-harm. So, yeah, great question. Or who knows? Maybe someone did do the one. Maybe she convinced some other, you know, disturbed person to cut her back. I won't pretend to know. I have not been able to come up with anything close to a satisfactory answer for that question.
All right, does this so, you know, Jean-Marc Vallée, you watched the post show.
Mm-hmm.
How does this leave you any more, less, or not at all excited for Big Little Lies season 2?
Oh, I'm very excited for that. I don't know if I'm more excited, but I mean, yeah, I'm very excited for that. Just the, you know, the cast additions alone.
Yeah, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm definitely going to check it out, but I can't say I'm particularly excited for Big Little Lies season 2.
Did you not enjoy the first season as much as I did?
Maybe. I mean, that might be true, but I would not say to the degree that it would be a big deal. It just feels like that was a story told fairly completely.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not all that anxious to revisit it. I would be more excited if you were like, this is an anthology show and we're doing a completely new cast than I think I am with the prospect of heading back to these worlds.
I hope there's not a
second, like, you know, shooting for sure.
That's
the second
true.
Season.
That's
you
true.
Know what I mean?
Right, right, right. But wasn't part of the joy of season one the incredible cast?
Yes. Yes, it was. But I don't know if that is enough to overcome sort of a would be sort of an iffy story. And I feel like this.
Well, but
this,
you're starting from scratch with the story, essentially, right?
Hopefully, I guess. So, I guess here's what I'm saying is like we. I think we both are on the same page about Sharp Objects in terms of the acting, right, and the cast. But I don't I, like. To me, this was kind of a B plus sort of show. Actually, yeah, no, I'm B minus B kind of show. You know what I mean? Where it was interesting, but I don't know that as I look back on that season as a whole that I found it all that enjoyable or that I would like really push someone to watch it.
All right, I suppose. I guess. Here's what I look at. The recipe for season one of Big Little Lies was a tour de force of these women sort of getting to play and play big roles and do big things. And
not just the women, by the way. I mean, the men in the cast there were some substantial
agreed,
presences.
But I'm just saying, yeah. The elevator pitch was, we got a murderer's row of ladies, and we're going to build a story around them.
Yeah.
And I guess I have as much faith in season two of that as I did in season one. And yeah, I guess it has to be a different story, but the only objection to that in my mind is just the old complaint of like, well, if the story's been told and this is a totally new story, I guess just crazy stuff happens in Monterey all the time. And my response to those criticisms are always, yeah, that's why we made a television show about it. The places where nothing happens, those are the ones we don't make the television
shows
about.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. You'd have to imagine the events of season one would be the craziest thing that would happen in any one person's life. But
yeah, sure. And every episode of House is the craziest medical diagnosis any normal doctor would ever have. But that's why there's a show about House and not about your doctor.
I guess. I didn't watch House.
I know. I of course. I hope and expect Big Little Lies season two to be a lot better than House episode 34. I'm just making the point. I think the criticism, too much happens in this town, it's just reflecting an inability to willingly suspend disbelief, which is what we have to do.
To me, it's a little less too much happens in this town because, you know, we know Monterey. Things can happen in Monterey. It just seems like a lot's really would be happening to these people. You know what I mean?
And that's going to be the case. And if that bothers you so much, then you probably won't like season two of Big Little Lies. But that doesn't really bother me.
All right. Well, like I said, I'm still interested in watching it, but I'm not like – I'm a little less excited. And I don't know that –
What about this?
I don't know. Jean-Marc Vallée's directing Flourishes. I'm not sure I'm totally here for that. But we can move on. I do want to ask, because I do kind of want to ask you, and we didn't talk about this in the rundown, but it just sort of made me think of it. You know, we both love Insecure. We're delighted with the first episode of the season. I feel like subsequent episodes have been a little meh, no? Like, not terrible, just kind of, you know?
I don't know if I would say that, but you know what they have been is, like, I've enjoyed them just as much, but there is a sort of a stagnation.
Yeah, I'm ready for Issa to manage this apartment because I feel like some funny things could happen out of that.
Yeah, the sort of stuck in the mire with the Daniel situation, I think, has more or less played itself out. But
yeah, and Daniel's work problems, despite the fact that we love music, they're not particularly interesting, right?
No, because he's just being a buffoon.
Yeah.
A character that you know, it's interesting. Almost up until this most recent episode, are you caught up?
Yeah.
So I feel like the end of the most recent episode may have been the sort of end of the Daniel drama, and I kind of hope it is. But I will say, like, even coming into this episode, I was kind of in the, why are they not just dating again?
Yeah.
Sort of camp, because as I remember, the only thing standing in their way was, like, the weird sexual mishap, for lack of a better description, from last season.
Which, like, I still don't fully get, but we can legislate that at a time.
Yeah, which we never got in the first place. Go ahead and go back to listen to our discussion at the time. But, like, we never totally understood, and it seems like a pretty weak reason to torpedo a relationship that you think has real possibilities, but whatever. Now they sort of... It seems like they did a lot of work to try to justify keeping this pair apart. That, like, they either should have given us better reasons or just skipped it.
I mean, it seemed like even her friends are kind of tired of the will there, won't they?
Exactly. On the other hand, I'm interested in – I think the Molly storyline is interesting right now, and I just – Issa Rae is – so wonderful.
Yeah, the show is wonderful. I'm just saying it's been a couple of so-so episodes.
Or at least it's a couple episodes where it feels a little bit like running in place.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. All right, speaking of, I guess we're not really speaking of running in place. I'm just going to segue to Lodge 49. We didn't really talk about this in the pre-show meeting. I watched the first two episodes.
I'm caught up because I watched the first two. And then yesterday, I was like, I want to see more. And then after the third one, I was like, I want to see tonight's episode. So I caught all the way up to last night.
Okay. So that I feel like that gives us a bit of a peek into where you're at with the show. What are the primary virtues of this for you?
There's a couple things. The most primary virtue, undoubtedly, is – Wyatt Russell, who is the lead actor. He is... I'm not sure I've seen as charming a layabout loser as Wyatt Russell since maybe, like, The Big Lebowski. He is just... To me, anyway, he's electric. He's playing this dumpy doofus who's literally stumbling through life. And I just think he's brilliant, man. I want to watch him. He's so charming. I want to hang out with him all the time. And I really think that's an achievement. The other thing about this show that makes it unique is like, there's not a lot to it. We don't, there's, and I heard this before, I heard someone talk about this before I actually had seen much of the show, and I didn't totally understand what they meant. But it's kind of delightful to just, in through four episodes, there is this weird, mysterious lodge stuff going on, and when you watch episode three, you'll see the weirdness around the lodge ratchets up a whole other level to what I think is hilarity. But it's a show where almost everything about it, all the laughs, all the joy, are just little character development things. And I can't really remember the last time a show gave me this many pretty normal feeling people that I'm this engaged with. Like, if someone was like, what's, in fact, you just asked, what's so engaging about this show? Like, the best answer really is just the human beings. The people are fun, and I laugh at them, and I laugh at their goofy situations. And I think that, you know, it's at some point there's going to have to be more, but I'm enjoying this. It's light and fun.
We talk a lot sometimes about shows we like, where we're just like, I really enjoy spending time in this world, whether, you know, it's, I don't know, Billions, I think, is a good example of that, you know, or like...
Where it's a different world.
Yeah, I just like hanging out with these people for an hour a week. And it seems like that is the place where you're at with this show. I am not there.
Okay, but let me differentiate. Because usually when we say that, I think we're talking about, like, some sort of intangible... Like, I would never actually live that world, you know? We're talking about Billions, where it's like this rarefied air of intensity and money.
Yeah,
I
think Insecure is like that, though, in a way, right? Where you're like, I love that Los Angeles that they live in. And theirs is an attainable Los Angeles, except for the general attractiveness of everyone on the show.
Yeah, you're right. It's not so much the attainability, maybe, but it's like the specificity. Does that make sense? Billions, Insecure, Game of Thrones, right? They're these very specific worlds. Lodge 49 is general.
Yeah.
It's not specific at all, which is a real change of pace to me. There's not even really a world to adjust to. There's like this sleepy beach community that's just like a blank canvas for these wacky people to walk across. And I really think it's a grower. Like, I feel like if you get the watch two more episodes this week at least, and I really feel like you'll start to get drawn in a little bit, because so much of those other shows, especially in the early going, are engaged in painting those specific worlds. And all the only stuff Lodge 49 has really been engaged in is painting these goofy characters so far. And again, the Lodge stuff starts to pick up in episodes 3 and 4, but it's all very silly and bizarre.
Yeah.
And it's really just a framework for these sort of...
I haven't been particularly charmed by the goofballs yet. And that's, you know, like, I don't know. I'm going to come off sounding more negative about the show than I am. I'm not negative about it. I'm not like, the show is boring and crap. I'm just kind of like, yeah.
Are you with me on Wyatt Russell, at least?
Yes. Yes, I am. I was just about to say, I get the charisma of Wyatt Russell. You know, we were fans of, or at least I'm a fan of Everybody Wants Some, the movie. And we both liked, I think, Playtest, which is the Black Mirror episode that he stars in. And
one of the best Black Mirrors, I thought.
I get the Wyatt Russell thing. I sort of enjoy his sister as a character.
Yeah, I really like her. She looks like an actress I know, but it's but she's not.
Yeah.
And then, do you know who I'm talking about?
Are you talking about the woman that was in that's been in some Sorkin stuff, like Sports Night and a few other things?
I'm going to find her name right now. I don't think so. I think the person I'm thinking of is too young to have been those things. Okay. I'm thinking of the young lady who was in the show Reaper. Her name is Missy Peregrim.
Gotcha. You know, she's in the show Reaper. That's probably not one I was going to be coming up with.
No, you were not going to be coming up. She's on that new Dick Wolf show, FBI. She's the lead on that.
Huh.
I'm not saying anything about Missy Peregrim's acting prowess, just that she looks like the woman who's playing Wyatt Russell's sister, and I don't think I've ever seen her before, is her name.
She's British. Man, the Brits do accents well. I would not have guessed that.
It's unbelievable. I also think like almost everyone on this show are people I don't recognize, which is rare.
I believe it's pronounced Pasquisi, David Pasquisi, who's Selena's husband on Veep.
Like there are some people who you've seen here and there,
but that's pretty much it. I feel like.
Yeah,
I definitely feel like Rip Torn turned down the role of the guy who was running the lodge at the beginning of the show.
Yes, Larry.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Like he just passed, and they got this other guy instead.
Well, my thing with all of this remains these characters, for me anyway, are charming. They're all kind of losers, and they're all bizarre, and I'm not sure it's clear where any of them are going. And again, like that's the sort of stuff that has to come together in some way, or we're left with nothing at the end. But I'm here for another 6 episodes to get there.
Gotcha. And I feel like I get what they're going for. You know what I mean? And it's not coming together for me yet. And I would say I would give it the episodes that you have watched, the 2 additional episodes. And if I didn't see it by then, I'm probably not coming back to last.
I'm gonna step out on a relatively fragile limb and say episodes 3 and 4 will lock it in for you.
All right.
In particular, a lot of the 4th episode is Ernie and Dud sort of together on an adventure, for lack of a better description. And I mean, ultimately, that's the core of the show for me, is Wyatt Russell and the guy who plays Ernie. His name is Brent Jennings. The two of them, they're just these really incredibly charming characters to me, and these sort of lovable, not exactly losers, but lovable
strugglers,
weird struggling nerds. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, Brent Jennings was Ron Washington in Moneyball.
Wow. Huh.
fun with Wikipedia. All right. Should we switch gears to, Travis Scott?
I think we better. Did you? I Googled or I typed Astroworld into Google just a little earlier, just to get the track list, and the first story that pops up is it is platinum as of today.
Yeah, it's gonna be it's quite successful, mm-hmm. And I don't want to. This is not to me like another one of those Cardi B style, like, oh my God, is this what the kids are into sort of things?
Can I ask you, what is your previous relationship with Travis Scott?
Almost none. I really like him. I liked his feature on that SZA song on her record.
Okay. That's all right.
That's about as far as it goes. For me, if you were to ask me to say, what does coasting on fame sound like? I would be like, hey, check out Astroworld by Travis Scott. All right, this is on trend vocoder auto-tuned hip hop.
I'll say this.
I found it really just uninteresting. Not bad. Like,
you know what's interesting about this?
I get why it's popular, but man, did nothing for me.
The way you describe this album is the way I felt about Travis Scott before this album. And I'm not going to say my opinion has changed that much. But I think from that place you're at now, having not heard, having heard probably about what you'd heard maybe a little more previously, this album actually was better than I expected. So I don't really disagree with what you're saying. And I think part of that comes down to the same stuff we said about Nicki Minaj last week, which is this is too much. This is way, way, way too much.
It's definitely too much. But, Nicki is so much more of an interesting voice.
I would say where Nicki has... Travis Scott is. Well, yeah. And I would say where Nicki has 6 or 7 of her 19 or 21 tracks that really are... that you could grab onto and go, this. If you did this for 10 songs, this would be a great album. On the Travis Scott album, there's like 2 songs and maybe 5 other verses. Because to me...
Yeah, like I feel like there's two songs where you're like, yeah, and then the other 15... Like it's hard for me to say which of those other 15 you should cut. You could cut or keep any of them to make, to make your 8 or 9 song record, right?
Yes. And I agree that way too much Travis Scott is exactly what you described. I wouldn't even call it coasting on fame. I would call it producing the moment. Or living pop culture in an album. Like, he's just doing the thing people are doing now, and he's talented, so he's going to do it just by sort of throwing it out there and doing the thing everyone's doing. He's going to do a pretty good version.
Yeah, he's not untalented. Right. That's a great way to put it. I just never felt like he gave a shit at any point in this record.
I think there's one point where it feels like he gives a shit, and it's the middle of Sicko Mode. And to me, that's where, like, when the beat changes and they get rid of Drake's sorry ass on Sicko Mode, there's like 2.5 minutes of one of the hottest pop rap tracks I've heard in the last couple years. Just like 2 hot, hot minutes. With references to old hip hop, with great lines, with an impressive flow, and I'm like, this is it. And then R.I.P. Screw, the very next song, I think is also a good song. But there's too much of this album, I'm waiting for that. I will say, my idea of Travis Scott before this album was auto-tune coaster, who's just doing the popular thing and getting by. And my opinion now is that, but man, he's actually pretty good when he goes in. And I wish he was trying harder. I guess I think of him more like Drake now than I used to. Right? That, like, a month ago, I probably would have said, I don't care that much about Travis Scott. He can keep doing his thing. And I just don't think there's much there ever, nor is there the possibility of much. And now I feel like, man, I wish he'd like sit down with an old head, like have a chat with Nas or Dr. Dre and be more selective.
Yeah.
And work a little harder at perfecting things rather than just cranking out tracks. But part of that's the world we live in, and maybe expecting an album to be anything more than 15 to 20 attempts at a single. Maybe we're in the wrong.
Yeah, I just feel old. That's what I feel.
Yeah, because I mean that's clearly what this is. Even more so than the Nicki album, which was sprawling and overdone. This is not really an album. It's just 17 attempts to make a hit single.
Yeah. There's no. You don't feel like there's any conceptual thought about how these songs
fit
together.
No, and in fact, maybe 18 attempts, because Sicko Mode, which is my favorite song in the album, is really two different songs, a mediocre Drake track with, like, just a vicious Travis Scott track thrown into the middle of it.
Is mediocre Drake track a redundant phrase at this point?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. I'm realizing more and more, even the Drake that I like, it's almost all about the beat.
Yep.
Which is obviously not his purview.
Correct. But like you could also, you know, there are some people that might tell you that the rapping is also not his purview.
Well, it's at least the writing.
Or the writing, yeah, the writing of said raps.
Yeah, what's it called? The new single, Nice for What? It's one of my favorite Drake songs. And the more I listen to it, the more I realize I don't care about the raps at all. The beat is banging. That Lauryn Hill sample is awesome. And Drake's fine.
Yeah, Drake's always fine. He's always fine.
And I'm always like, why aren't you doing better? That's always my response to Drake.
Yeah, I don't know that the kids really are demanding that their heroes do better.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about music.
Yeah.
Just make me an earworm. Make me one or two earworms a year, and you'll stay in there. That's what Drake has done.
Right. But the second you don't, they'll cut you. That's true. That is true.
It's not necessarily easier to succeed. It's just it requires a different skill set.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a low bar, but you better hit it. all right, but before we get to homework, I did want to throw out one thing that sort of popped up in the news today. We have been on the record as pretty big fans of the work of Louis C.K. in the past, and then I think both we, you know, his hashtag Me Too misadventures, you know, honestly, that's probably putting too much of a glib spin on it, like, you know, his gross stuff he did,
the sexual crimes he committed,
were I think hard on us, you know, as we've discussed at length.
Can I, before we get into this, just to, so that when people are done listening to this likely unpleasant conversation about Louis C.K., they can put a better taste in their mouth, can I just strongly recommend that anybody with any attachment or interest in the Me Too sort of movement and empowering women in 2018, a mere 1,000 years after we should have, read Steph Curry's article in the Players Tribune. It's just a sort of piece about his life and his daughters and what it means to be an ally to women and an advocate for women. And it's eloquent and right-minded and moving, frankly. And everyone should read it.
Yeah, I'll check that out. Because I have not seen that.
Highly recommended. He's, you know, I mean, obviously it's well-edited, but it does a great job of capturing his voice so you feel like Steph Curry's talking to you, and also really intelligently and eloquently laying out what it means to be a feminist, basically.
Yeah. The controversy today about Louis C.K. is that, you know, he performed last night, and there have been a couple people, I think Michael Ian Black is probably most prominent among them, who are sort of like talking about how there needs to be some way for people who've done horrible things to eventually find their way back into society, that we shouldn't hold things against people forever. And I see the logic in that somewhere.
Well, first of all, let's just say quickly, to some degree, that is obviously true. There's obviously a level at which misdeeds should be atonable. But there is also obviously a level at which misdeeds are no longer atonable. And the question for everybody is, what falls on which side of that line?
Right. I mean, look, I hate slippery slope arguments, but you can certainly get into that. It's like, look, I'm not ever going to forgive R. Kelly.
No.
You know, I mean, it you know, he's so far past that line. He's sort of a really obvious example because he's not even really contrite about what he's done.
Yeah.
But even if he were to be, like, it's just a bridge too far. But, you know, I guess that line is sort of different for everyone. The thing to me is, like, yes, like, how we readmit people who have made sexual mistakes and tried to learn from them back into the culture is a thing that we should consider. But I just feel like it should be so much further down the list of things that we're considering about these sort of Me Too situations. You know what I mean? There's an empathy for the person who's made the art that we like, that to me feels really unearned, you know, like that we should really be so much more thinking about is the time appropriate for the people who were victimized by this guy or have had their lives and careers ruined. Like, are they cool with him coming back? Cause that to me is much more interesting than whether or not it seems like the right time for Louis C.K. to do stand up again, you know?
Well, interesting and relevant. I think we would agree.
Yeah.
Right. What matters is how those people feel. What matters is not if you and I are ready to watch him again. What matters is, has any of the damage he did been mitigated at all to this point? And there's no way for us to answer that. And
I would be very surprised if you're talking about the damage in the lives of the individuals who have, you know, stepped forward and said he did this to me.
Is it doing further damage to revive his career? And I you know, I can't say I know, but I'm with you that it seems to me I don't get the, like, I don't feel it's not important to me that Louis C.K. gets back on the stage at the first moment that it's okay for him to do so.
Yep.
That seems very unimportant to me. What I'll say, you know, separate from that, as it pertains to him and his comedy specifically, just from a personal perspective, let's just say for the sake of argument, every woman he transgressed against said, you know what, I believe he's contrite, I believe he understands what he did wrong and won't do it again, and if he wants to work, God bless. Even if they said that, I don't know that I'll be able to watch him anymore, and I know I won't be able to watch him the same way and laugh the same way, because as much as any comedian, maybe more so than any comedian, I feel like Louis C.K. worked in the territory where I only really felt like it was okay for him to say these things and okay for me to laugh at them because I trusted that he knew where the line was between thoughts and feelings and desires you can express in a comedic way as a way of working through stuff versus behavior you would actually engage in. And the fact that he doesn't know where that line is clearly makes it hard for me to imagine laughing at jokes that toy with the idea of him inappropriately crossing those lines.
Yeah. I mean, trust was such a big part of,
it was a huge
of that
part.
Experience. And then I don't know how you get that back. I don't totally know how I'll feel when his work comes out, but my expectations probably would fall right in line with you.
Like in the same way that I'm going to skew it differently because I think it's easier to understand, right? Because I think Louis's gender humor falls in much the same category as his race humor. And this is a man, a white man, you know, Mexican heritage notwithstanding. This is a white man who has basically been given a pass for saying the N-word repeatedly because of the thoughtful manner in which he did it. But we only laugh at those jokes and trust him to make those jokes because we believe he truly does understand the vicious power of that word and is in fact drawing our attention to it. If we found out that at home, around his young daughters, he was using that word with reckless abandon, we would not laugh at those jokes.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about his gender humor. So now maybe he avoids that, and maybe that makes it more palatable. But the trust overall is significantly eroded. And I even find it hard to confront the idea of going back and watching old material that I already loved.
Yeah.
Because I'm worried about how I'll feel now that I know he doesn't know where the line is.
I haven't revisited any of his stuff, and you know,
me neither.
We love a lot of that stuff. I mean, like the thought of watching Horace and Pete, you know, post these allegations.
It's horrifying.
It seems unbearable.
Yes.
You know, I do think it's going to be interesting, and maybe I've made this point before. You know, he has built his own platform in a way, you know, that he's shown some ability to sell directly to people who are interested in his work.
He's going to be much harder to silence in that respect than the average comedian.
And so that's another reason why all this is so crazy, is because I think he's going to get his opportunity, at least with a large enough group of people, that he probably will be able to make a living. He could probably do it right now. Not that he needs the money. You know, he's clearly made enough money to never work again. But, you know, so we're going to find out a lot of these things. And maybe time will, you know, bring back some of that trust. But I certainly, that's not what I would predict at this point.
No, me neither.
Yeah.
Me neither.
All right. Should we move on to homework?
Yes, sir.
So I know we talked about Ozark coming back. Is this the week? Is that a thing?
This is the week. Ozark's back this week, and the NFL is back next week. So I'm sure we'll do some NFL preview next week. There is a brand new show coming to Amazon, one that we have heard an awful lot about over the last 6 months, and I'm wondering if you're interested in checking it out, and that is Jack Ryan.
Yeah, I'm vaguely interested in checking it out.
Okay.
Vaguely interested. I'm not a, like, huge... I haven't had a huge interest in the world of Jack Ryan before.
Me neither.
You know?
Clear and Present Danger was probably my favorite of the Jack Ryan experiences, you know?
But yeah, you know, I'd check out and see what Amazon is doing with the form.
Right, because what it is this is one of the big entries, and we're about to get a bunch of these over the next couple years. One of the big entries in the, you know, streaming service or premium channel attempts to create blockbuster level action.
Yeah,
for television.
I'm interested in that for that reason.
Uh huh.
I wanted to ask you, and I'm not totally sure I want to watch this, so I'm not necessarily suggesting it. Have you heard at all about to All the Boys I've Loved Before?
Yes, let's put that on the list. I'm very interested in it.
You know, I do sort of enjoy some teenage melodrama.
We both do, and I'm a big rom-com guy, and I've heard good things, so it's absolutely should go on the list.
All right, I've heard some mixed things about that, but I'd be willing to check that out. I want to throw out a band.
Okay.
This is not a popular band, so.
you're treading into my water. Be careful.
Yeah, but there's been a lot of good buzz on a band out of St. Louis called Foxing.
Oh, I have heard of them, but I have not heard them. Like, Foxing, yes.
Like boxing with the letter F in front instead.
It's like Foxy Boxing.
Yeah, exactly. Their new record, which I believe is called Nearer My God, if I have that correct.
I'm not sure, but not to be confused with Foxygen, which is a different band.
Different band, yeah. Foxygen is a different band. If you like that kind of, Radiohead-y sort of art rock, which, as you know,
I do
quite a bit, I think you might be interested in this Foxing record. So,
I am on a totally unrelated note other than the alliteration. Foxygen, I'm a fan. They're more in the sort of lighthearted indie rock, though.
Yes. Yeah. Have you heard about Drew Michaels' stand-up set?
No.
I've
never even heard of Drew Michaels.
It's Drew Michael. I meant Michael apostrophe S, if that makes
got
sense.
Got it. Never even heard of him. Or
A friend of mine told me he's the male Nanette. So,
Well, we liked Nanette, and look, that elevator pitch has me ready.
So that's a lot of stuff. I don't know if we can get to all of that in the time allotted.
But we're gonna damn well try. I'm also gonna see three Fish concerts.
Are you?
Yes.
There is a chance. There's a pretty good chance that I'm gonna see Taylor Swift this weekend.
Oh, nice.
I
support that. I've never seen Taylor Swift because I don't have that kind of money, but I support that.
As you know, I'm on the record as not enjoying Taylor Swift. So
I know. Well, that's why I'm trying to boost you up, man. I mean, look, you're not. It's gonna be a fun show.
Yeah.
Like you at the very least, you'll appreciate Taylor Swift's stage prowess in a way that you appreciated like Bruno Mars, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'm sort of interested in the spectacle. Mildly interested in the sociology, although I feel like I have a pretty good idea it's going to be a Taylor Swift show.
I think we all know that it's going to be a lot of mothers and daughters.
Yeah. But, you know, I saw Hamilton last weekend. You know how I feel about musicals, so.
How'd that go? We never talked about it.
Yeah, you're right. We didn't talk about it. So my quick take on Hamilton is the artistic achievement, the breadth of what Lin-Manuel accomplished, the idea of taking a 900-page nonfiction book about the life of Alexander Hamilton that's dry at best and conceiving I'm going to make a hip-hop musical out of it is brilliant. From a formal perspective, it is incredible. From a technical spectacle, it is incredible. From a staging standpoint, it is incredible. You know, I didn't see the original Broadway cast. I'm getting, you know, I got the permanent Chicago cast, which I'm going to guess may not even be the off-Broadway cast. And yet,
careful.
The talent on display was phenomenal. I don't think there was a wrong note the entire night, you know? So I like the craft and achievement of it, I appreciated greatly. I just think that there were times, particularly in the end, that I found moving. But I think there is just a certain cap upon which I enjoy people expressing complex emotion through the idiom of song.
Yep. Well, same page, and that's pretty much what I thought you'd say, so I guess that's why we didn't talk about it.
The first act dragged a little bit for me. The second half I thought was a little tighter, although I do think they sort of yada yada some things in the second half, so maybe I'm trying to have it both ways. I don't know.
Also, isn't that the nature of the musical though? Is like you're not exactly yada yadaing, but you're like la la laing a lot of stuff.
Yeah. There's a lot of la la laing, and yeah, there's just some of the hokiness that goes with all musicals and you know, trying to play on the stage to the balcony that just doesn't sit that well with me.
Did you see
at the end of the day
Ethan Hawke's quotes this week?
I did not.
Okay, I'm gonna find them because a friend of mine retweeted it angrily because she likes pop culture very much. But here's the quote. People asked Ethan Hawke, specifically Film Stage magazine, asked Ethan Hawke about the marginalization of indie movies and the propping up of superhero movies. And here's what he said. Now we have the problem that they tell us Logan is a great movie. Well, it's a great superhero movie. It still involves people in tights with metal coming out of their hands. It's not Bresson. It's not Bergman, but they talk about it like it is. I went to see Logan because everyone was like, this is a great movie. And I was like, really? No, this is a fine superhero movie. There's a difference, but big business doesn't think there's a difference.
That feels pretty airtight to me. I don't really know.
It's incredibly, just incredibly pretentious, no doubt. But it's also accurate.
Yep.
And that, to me, not exactly the artistic application is not the same, but there's a similar effect with musicals. And there's this idea that, like, we're all just going to agree that telling stories in song with rhymes is pretty tough. So it's going to involve a bunch of cheesy BS.
Yeah.
And I'm with you that, like, okay, but then that's just a form I'm not especially interested in.
Right.
Now, I'm more interested in superhero movies because I get more out of explosions than I do out of song. But to me, I love music when it's taken seriously and done with care. And I love theater when it's taken seriously and done with care. And a musical, to me, is a combination of the two done without seriousness or care.
Yeah. And it's like when you watch something like Once, which, God, I hadn't thought about in a long time, mm-hmm. which is like a musical where the music actually realistically fits into a story and doesn't have any of that artifice.
Exactly.
You just sort of go, well, why can't this be done more? You know, right. like.
Exactly. Well, and the reason is because in order to do that, you have to have a story about people singing music. And there's only so many stories you want to tell about people singing music. I suppose
that's true. It's impossible to do a story about Alexander Hamilton that has music in that context. But it's like there are moments that like when they are doing the rap battles in the cabinet of Hamilton. Have you seen Hamilton? Sorry, no. We didn't establish that. In real life, obviously, Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton had some disputes about philosophy and size of government and, you know, the federal banking system and all of that. And those disputes play out in the play as, like, battle rap. Like, each guy gets a verse and they kind of insult each other. And that works perfectly. And obviously, that's not a realistic representation of how that happened. You know what I mean?
Right.
But like, and that was great and it really crackled to me. But like hearing Alexander and Eliza Hamilton wander through the streets of New York and hear her go like, look around, what a wonderful time we are to be alive. We're so lucky to be in the greatest city in the world. And I'm like, this is like, this is every musical. And you know, and I don't need
like,
that. The story doesn't need that.
Is it the exact same song as La La Land or like slightly different?
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, like I could be watching Our Town right now. You know what I mean? So
yeah, this just became musical bash, which seems unnecessary. So yeah,
I agree. But anyway, that's my thoughts on Hamilton. You know, I'm not the target audience, clearly. But I'm glad I saw it, and I have tremendous respect for what it took to put that on. Tremendous
There's no
respect.
Question.
Yeah.
And Lin-Manuel Miranda's a genius. I don't think anybody's debating that. All right. So homework is Jack Ryan, Ozark, To All the Boys I've Loved Before, a little bit of NFL preview, and then music from Foxing and Drew Michael.
Comedy from Drew Michael.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Music from Foxing and comedy from Drew Michael.
Yeah. I'm not going to fault you if you don't get to all that because we have lives. You got a daily show you got to work on.
I got a daily show to prepare. Starts Wednesday, September 5th. Don't miss it. 5A to 6A every weekday morning. 95.7.
Are you just curious? I know we got to go, but are you planning to talk any college football on the show? Is this going to get you to watch a little college football this fall?
Almost none, my friend. Almost none.
Yeah, I should have guessed. It's a Bay Area show, but I'm going to. Obviously, I'm watching less NFL this year, so I'm probably going to dive into college quite a bit, and I got nowhere to talk about it with.
Yeah.
I'll find somebody. All right. Have a great week. Let's do this again soon.
Okay, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.